Well, good morning, friends. It's Friday here at Coast Community Radio, and I'm your host, Jim Wilkins, ably assisted by Terry Wilson, our engineer par excellence. And today we're doing kind of a new maneuver that we haven't done in a while. We've got a phone patch to Salem, and we're going to be speaking with our state senator, Betsy Johnson, who originally had hoped to come over and appear in person, but because of a doctor's appointment, she's going to appear by phone. Betsy, are you there?
I am. I'm front and center and ready to go.
Cool. And the Friday show was originally conceived by Lisa Smith, and it's produced by Kathleen Morgain. So welcome aboard, Betsy.
Well, the very pleasant part was that I saw Lisa Smith on election night. I had been down hosting, or not hosting, judging the Iron Chef Goes Coastal on election night, and when that was over, I scooted up to Fort George, and Lisa was there, so it was very nice to see her.
Right. So, the election.
Well, the election was very, very interesting, and Oregon ran completely counter to the United States. Nationally, the Republicans ran the table. They took the majority of 10 legislative chambers previously held by Democrats. And just to run through those quickly, Colorado Senate, Maine Senate, Minnesota House, Nevada Assembly, Nevada Senate, New Hampshire House, New York Senate, New Mexico House, Washington Senate, and West Virginia House. That Washington Senate is interesting, and we'll come back to that in just a second. The West Virginia Senate is currently tied 17-17. So it really was rather stunning. Oregon ran counter to that, and certainly there was a pickup in the House and a pickup in the Senate for the D's, and so we ran counterintuitive to where the nation was.
Well, that sounds pretty exciting.
Well, it was, and as you know, we had several very interesting races. I think everyone, they were interesting races, a lot because of the background noise, and then we had very controversial measures. And just to start this, in preparation, I was sort of thinking about some of the races. A lot of people, I think, wonder, does their vote count? And the interesting thing is that over in Jefferson County, for the Jefferson County Commission right now, the two candidates are separated by one vote. And so it's Mae Houston and Tom Brown, and they're separated by a single vote. Turnout was not exactly stellar in Columbia County. Clatsop was off the chart, and statewide it wasn't great. In Clatsop County, 72% showed up. And I think that's indicative of the fact that Clatsop remains a pretty plugged-in politically place. Columbia only had 64%. Statewide, there was 69.5%. But I think the Merkley race for United States Senator, the Merkley-Webby race, was pretty much nobody had expected there to be any significant change there. Clatsop County, for example, Merkley got 57% to Webby's 36. The governor's race ended up being way closer than anybody had imagined, way closer. In fact, Richardson won in Clatsop County.
Well, Kitzhaber is not thought of highly here in Clatsop County.
No, I know that, and I think particularly after the whole Gillnet situation and the upending of ballot measure 81, and I think that has the dislike of Kitzhaber has factored in very largely into the proposal that the three South County mayors have about restructuring the Port of Astoria. And when one of the suggestions that the mayors came up with was that the governor would be presented with a pool drawn from Clatsop County folks, and ultimately the governor would have appointing authority, I think the visceral dislike of the governor in Clatsop County colored people's reaction to the mayor's proposal right out of the box, because they don't like him so much. Richardson won in Columbia County by even a wider margin than Clatsop County, And then, of course, statewide, it was 44.7 or 49.7 for Kitzhaber to 44.4 for Richardson. In my opinion, if Richardson had been a stronger candidate, Kitzhaber would not have been reelected to an unprecedented fourth term.
And then here in Astoria, we have set a historical precedent in that the city council is now a majority of women.
As it should be. I love it when they let girls lead. No, I think I think that is a very interesting phenomena, and I congratulate the new counselors and the mayor. I know all of those women well, and will certainly look forward to working with them in their new capacities. One of the things that I've so enjoyed in my service is very close relationships with local elected officials, because I think sometimes folks forget we share the same constituents. We serve the same people. And cities and counties, along with the state, ought to have the kind of harmonious relationships that allow us to deliver for our shared voters.
Well, one of the measures that did pass this time was the marijuana law. How do you think that's going to impact the state, and how is Salem going to react to that?
Well, frankly, I think that is going to be extraordinarily difficult. And first of all, I think people think, well, it passed, so I can go light up a fatty and walk around with it today. Not so. The marijuana initiative does not take effect in Oregon until quite a while out, and so we've got some prep time to get ready. But I think the biggest problem is going to be, what do we do in terms of creating the enabling legislation? It doesn't become effective until July 1st of 2015, so
right.
Keep those doobies in your pocket until then. But there has been a suggestion that the OLCC would be the controlling state agency. And Steve Marks, who's the executive director of the OLCC, and Rob Patrich, who has kind of an interesting dual role. He is the DA of Klamath County, and he's also the chair of the OLCC Commission. They have both already opined that the Liquor Control Commission is going to take the lead, work with other agencies to try to implement ballot measure 91. But it raises a whole bunch of questions. What's going to be the supply and the demand? How will recreational marijuana interface with the medicinal dispensaries? How will dispensaries be appointed? Are they going to be OLCC outlets, where we already have in place a regulatory framework? How will price be affected by supply and demand? The biggest thing that the feds have opined on, because it remains still against the law at the federal level, is how the U.S. attorney is going to integrate what we have done in order to effectuate ballot measure 91, but still how the federal government is going to deal with it. And then I think one of the biggest questions that probably augured against the passage, and at least a lot of people were concerned about it, was what do you do about the distribution of products that are child-friendly but are infused with cannabinol? And so that's going to be a real conundrum for folks to work with. Some guy in Portland was already talking about putting in vending machines to make products available. How do you keep kids away from those? And as I said to somebody the other day, while there were almost 750,000 people who said this was a good idea, we shouldn't forget that there were 600,000 people that said this was a bad idea. And so how we work out the details is going to be very problematic. Just for example, federal law still prohibits transporting marijuana across state lines, which means if you drive across the bridge in Astoria and go up into Washington, you can't drive into Washington and bring the marijuana with you, even though it's legal in both states. So trying to sort out how we interact with federal law, how we create our own distribution network. This is not going to be simple, and people are going to be impatient to get going because I think lots of folks, entrepreneurs, see a money-making opportunity. I think there's going to be a segment of the population that remains concerned about accessibility. Police haven't worked out the protocols on driving while using marijuana the same way that they've worked out driving while drunk. So folks have spoken. They spoke all over the country. We've got other states and the District of Columbia that now approve of recreational marijuana. So getting it worked into the system is not going to be without its problems. But Oregonians have said yes to legalizing it, and we're going to do what we can to make sure that there is a speedy and meaningful integration with existing law and effectuate what the voters voted for.
And will the state legislature be taking the lead on some of these questions?
Well, as long as a state agency, specifically OLCC, is in the lead, the legislature, which handles OLCC's budget, we will probably be included. What OLCC has said is their first step is that they understand that there are lots of policy questions, and they're going to begin an outreach, extensive public and stakeholder input listening session. And so Rob Patridge, the chair of the commission, said they're going to be out all over the state listening. And they have already articulated their interest in supporting law enforcement in law enforcement's efforts to prevent unlicensed sales and production. So the legislature will be involved. We're not going to change the substance of the policy decision that the voters made. As long as the state agency's in the lead, the legislature will be there. Also, I think state police will be involved, because even when the measure goes into effect at the beginning of July of 2015, if individuals possess more than the 8 ounces of marijuana per residence and they grow more than 4 plants, there's going to be enforcement issues. And then recently I got a call from a constituent who lives next door to a guy that is growing medicinal marijuana, and the two neighbors have a dispute because neighbor one, who is not the grower, asserts that the resin and the smell and the activities are wafting over the fence and having a deleterious effect on his wife's health. And so we're going to have to work all of that out. I just would conclude, Jim, by saying one of the great ironies for me was the fact that we had on our ballot the question of legalizing recreational marijuana, but also the question of labeling GMO.
Right.
And for lots of people that know anything about marijuana back in the old days, the only reason that modern-day marijuana is any damn good is because of GMO. So it struck me as a kind of humorous little irony. And, of course, the genetic modification bill, a ballot measure, is still too close to call unless something happened overnight that I'm unaware of, but it was too close to call yesterday.
Well, I'd like to remind our listeners that it's Friday here at Coast Community Radio, and we're visiting with our state senator, Betsy Johnson. Appreciate you being with us here, Betsy.
I appreciate the accommodation. I was planning on being up there, and you and I have something in common. I think we're both slated for new hips pretty soon, and I had to do a doctor's appointment today in anticipation of mine, and so I just couldn't make it work to be in the studio. I had wanted to come up, though.
Yeah, I was looking forward to visiting with you in person, but on phone it works just fine. But as far as the new hips, I've been asking around. Once they put the new hip in us, and we each have one scheduled, what do they do with the old ones?
You know, that's sort of gross. I've thought about it. I presume they just throw them away, unless they turn out to be a soup bone. No, that's too gross. I leave that to the surgeons and the technicians in the operating room. That's just something I don't need to know.
Okay. Say, listen, Betsy, we got a question that came in here by phone. I'll just read it to you. One of the top campaign issues in Warrenton was the new flood maps and the insurance rates. Do we have any positive news for businesses and homeowners in some of the low elevations over there in Warrenton?
Well, yes and no. First of all, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is a federal program. I've been watching it very closely because if you think about what my district, Northwest Oregon, looks like, all of it's behind some kind of dike or levee or tide gate or flood management device someplace. I'll tell you a quick funny story. I represent all of Savis Island, which has, I think, 18 miles of lineal dike around it. And I had a constituent who bought a new house out there say to me, God, I'd have such a good view of Mount St. Helens if I could just knock down that berm. Well, that berm is the dike. So if you think about how much of Northwest Oregon is behind some kind of water management device, the two problems occurred simultaneously. First of all, FEMA began this remapping process. FEMA began the remapping process in no small measure by the catastrophes that happened with Sandy and Katrina. FEMA, in my opinion, has been capricious and dictatorial and virtually impossible to work with as local communities struggled to figure out what to do. And FEMA has had the hammer of holding out availability of insurance as a real motivator. I think the way they've used it is unconscionable, but that's what they've done. And so FEMA has come in and redone these maps. They have done them kind of casually, and FEMA has admitted on television stations in the Portland area that they made mistakes, and FEMA's attitude is sort of, yeah, we made mistakes, get over it. However, if you are affected by these maps and the effect is negative on most people's largest single asset, their home, they're not going to get over it. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that Congress passed an amendment called the Wright Amendment that made it impossible for federal agencies to compete with the private sector. And, yeah, is there something good about that? Maybe. But in the case of the recertification of dikes and levees, where diking districts or dike improvement districts have historically worked with the Corps of Engineers, and they set aside a de minimis amount of money to have the Corps come out and help with the recertification. In some cases, the Corps built these structures. And I'll give you an example in Scappoose. We have a big diking district, drainage district, and they set aside generally between $30,000 and $50,000 in the past to do the recertification. This time, the Corps said, we're not going to partner with you, and as a result, you have to go get a private engineering firm. So the folks in Scappoose went out and got the private engineering firm. The private engineering firm said, this is going to cost you $2 million, and it has a finite shelf life, and we're going to have to send in an army of engineers to get this done. And the folks responsible for the dikes just came to the community and said, we can't afford it.
Right.
And so now you live behind an uncertified dike. So one of the things that I'm in the process of doing is authoring a bill in conjunction with the Oregon Business Development Department, and in fact, I'm going to meet with their director later this afternoon, and we are putting together a bill that remains a work in progress right now, but it will provide for grants for these legal entities that are responsible for dikes and levees and water management devices to get a grant to assay the condition, the physical condition of their assets, and then if they need recertification or some kind of work, the legislature, God willing, will authorize a pool of money that would be provided to the legally responsible entities at a very reduced rate so that they can afford to make the improvements. There are also a lot of other frictions that are going on here as we start talking about dikes and levees. And in my experience, this is the first time this issue has come into the public square the way that it has with FEMA's remapping and the Wright Amendment. But it is who pays for all of this. Savis Island, for example, has farmers that historically have lived behind the dike. They were the voting members of the diking district. They were the people that took legal responsibility. But there has been the infusion of a lot of private homeowners, in some cases living in very expensive homes, they get the benefit of the dike but have not been included in the district for the purpose of assessing fees. And so I think somewhere along the line we're going to have a collective conversation of what defines beneficiary, the term or the concept of beneficiary of those folks that are behind the dike. So to answer the question that got called in, we're working on this bill at the state level. There is a lot more conversation about what do we do as assets behind uncertified dikes and are devalued. What happens if homeowners get caught in the FEMA remapping that admittedly is inaccurate and their insurance rates are soaring? So while I don't have a specific suite of answers right now, I can tell you that Representative Boone, Representative Witt, and I are acutely aware of this. It has become a discussion point for what's called the Coastal Caucus. We are the legislators, both Republican and Democrat, House and Senate, who represent the coast. And because so much of the coast is similarly situated, the issue of what do we do, how do we bring financial relief, how do we get the rules in place that are equitable, this will be a huge topic of conversation in the 15th legislature. The last piece of bad news is that it is going to take a fair amount of education to help urban people understand the impact of lowlands along the coast and the impact of the need to get these water management devices recertified. The good news is that Multnomah County has two big projects, and Oregon Solutions is working in Multnomah County. They happen to be in Speaker Kotek's sphere of influence. I think that Tina Kotek is going to be the speaker again when we are back in session in February. And if she has an interest in it and she can extrapolate from her two dikes in her general area out to the 400 or so in Tillamook County, and I'm just using Tillamook as an example, there's probably an equal number in Columbia that has the largest stretch of the Columbia River and a whole bunch of them in Clatsop County, it's going to be a very hot topic of conversation. I don't have answers right now, but it is high on the priority list of the legislature.
You know, one thing I'm not hearing in the discussions of the dikes and levees is the climate change that we're experiencing and the resultant rise in sea level. Why isn't that part of the discussion?
Well, that's a question that John McKesson out in Brownsmead has been asking me incessantly because Brownsmead, of course, is so low. And it needs to be part of the discussion because some of the levees that exist now or things that we should and could be planning for will be affected by a rise in sea level. The other thing that we haven't talked about to any great degree is what happens if there is a Cascadia subduction event or there is a distant tsunami that comes blowing onto our coastline and wipes out some of these dikes and levees. Who then is responsible for putting them back together again, especially when some of them were built by the Corps of Engineers and date back to World War II?
I'm trying to make sense of this question that was handed to me here, Betsy, so bear with me.
Okay.
The GMO ballot measure that failed increased THC not through GMOs, but rather through selected breeding and hybridization. This caller believes that the GMO camp may have misled people about how pot growers have increased THC levels and rather than through GMOs or selected breeding. Caller wants Betsy's comments regarding this proposed misinformation.
Well, I was actually being kind of flippant. I'm glad for the edification. I am not a scientist. I'm not a student of how the THC has been increased in the current version of the very high octane marijuana that's being grown. And so I was really trying to be funny, and I appreciate the correction. I don't know that I have a comment. I don't know whether or not selective breeding. Whether or not that constitutes any kind of genetic modification where you're selecting You know, going back to the experiments with flowers, getting the different color flowers as you mix the genes of flowers around. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the technical or the scientific definition really is. And so the next time before I smart off about, what I saw as the little irony on the ballot, and I was truly trying to be funny, I don't have any scientific background to make that comment. It's something I probably ought to learn about. But if one manipulates strains and breeds strains together in different ways, if you're breeding strains of corn together to make them fungus resistant, or you're breeding marijuana plants to make the resin and the THC more potent, I'm not sure that I completely understand the difference. I'm a history major. I didn't do so well in science. and so I would have to leave that to the scientists. I don't know that I have a comment.
Okay. We've got just a little over 2 minutes left, Betsy. I'm wondering if you've got any words of wisdom that you can share with our...
Sure. Let me just tell you what the schedule is going to be in the near short term, because people will want to follow it. We will go this weekend, this coming up weekend, not tomorrow, but the next weekend, the Senate Democrats, and we will organize. And I believe the other four caucuses are doing the same. So you've got the House Republicans, House Democrats, Senate Republicans, Senate Democrats, and they all go off and elect their leadership. We have been working on what the Senate Democrats' 2015 agenda is. And no big surprise, we're going to be investing in education and workforce development, trying to strengthen businesses and create family wage jobs. I have pushed very hard to have part of our agenda be to stand up for rural places. I think there's going to be a temptation by the very urban-dominated legislature to forget that all of Oregon's economy has to come along for us to say that we really have recovered from this depression we were in. We're going to be working still to help vulnerable citizens, the elderly, the people that struggle through no fault of their own. And I'm very pleased to say that part of our agenda is going to be to try to ensure efficient and accountable government, especially in the wake of the disasters of the wasted money on the CRC and Cover Oregon. None of us can make any brief for how that was handled. It was appalling, and
yes,
we wasted a lot of money, and we need to earn
a lot of money.
Yeah, and I will say those were executive branch issues, but we've got to earn confidence back. So we elect our leadership. Then in December, we come in for legislative days. That'll be, I think, December 8, 9, and 10. In January, we come in for some organizational, and then in February, we're back in earnest. And I hope people familiarize themselves with a thing called the Oregon Legislative Information System, or OLIS. You can just Google it. And it is a portal, an almost real-time portal of entry into the activities of the legislature. And if people want to follow what's going on, we can talk about it again. I can make information available on my website. I can send it to KMUN. I think my show is coming back on KMUN, and we can do a full tutorial on OLIS. But for people that live at a distance and can't get to Salem, the Oregon Legislative Information System is the easiest way to follow what's going on in Salem.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, Betsy. Sorry to give you the bad news, but we're going to have to wind this program up because we only get half an hour. Now, you're coming. Your show starts again back on Monday?
I think so. I'll have to leave that up to KMUN, but I hope I'm back on KMUN's air now that the election's over.
Well, Terry Wilson is nodding his head that, yes, you'll be back on KMUN on Monday. So
good.
We appreciate that. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the accommodation, and good luck on your surgery.
Yeah. Oh, a caller did call in and say that you can take the bone that is removed from your hip and make a cane top, a handle for your cane.
I'll take that under advisement. I'm seeing my surgeon today. I'll ask if that's an option. I take it home in a little plastic bag or something.
Yeah. Very good. Thanks, Betsy.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.